The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Frisch, Judge Clary, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this fourth argument today for the October 6, 2022 panel of the Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar this morning is Bruntlett v. Bruntlett. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those restrictions as the timing is indicated on your screen. Speaking of which, we are not live today, but we are having our oral arguments by online presentation through Zoom. So counsel, I will give you a couple of pointers in that regard. One, if we get glitchy at all, and so far the technology has worked out fine, but if you have any difficulty hearing or seeing anyone during the argument, either the judges or opposing counsel, just let us know and we'll try to let the technology get sorted out. And secondly, because we're only, even though we can see each other and see each other's names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceeding as we always do. So please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the benefit of the public recording. And with that, counsel for appellant. Now, I think counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. May it please the court. This matter should have been disposed of at summary judgment. It was a simple contract matter and there were no factual disputes. Appellant Kevin Bruntlett and his mother Evelyn entered into a contract in 1982 where Kevin had the option to purchase 440 acres of farmland for $200,000. The option contract was complete. It identified the parties. It contained the legal description of the property subject to the option. It set forth the price. It set forth the term of the option, and it was duly recorded. Kevin Bruntlett had the right to exercise the option at any time during his lifetime. It is a complete contract. It is enforceable. No other evidence should have even been admitted, but objections citing the parole evidence rule were ignored. Court even indicated that the contract was enforceable in its order, but the court failed to enforce it, and that is error.
Mr. Johnson?
Yes.
What evidence is there in the record that Evelyn ever agreed to Kevin's calculation of the monetary value of his alleged contributions to the farm?
Yeah, there is no evidence in the record to that effect, and that's not an issue on appeal.
If there's no evidence of that, then how do we have an apples to apples, here's the offer, here's the acceptance meeting of the, assuming that, you know, if it's true, he's saying, look, I already paid the money, therefore it's done, it's fait accompli. I've already accepted the offer. How can you say that that's so if the offer did not include, the option did not include anything other than cash, and there's no indication that the contributions that were provided by your client's alleged labor on the farm was either accepted by Evelyn or was accepted in the amounts that are asserted by your client?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the contract was formed in 1982, okay? And we had brought in, you know, at the time we had argued that some of these contributions, because of the agreement between Evelyn and Kevin, should have been counted toward the contract price. But the contract was complete in 1982. And we've given up on, that evidence wasn't great, okay? That these contributions of labor, the in-kind labor, should go toward the purchase price as set out in the contract. We're not arguing for that anymore. We are arguing that the $70,000 that was paid and proven on a contract, you know, that should be credited. But the in-kind, the in-kind labor that we had, you know, attempted to present at trial, we understand that that was not great evidence. And we're not suggesting that that should be counted toward the purchase price. What my statement is that the contract itself was complete in 1982. All of the terms were there for $200,000. So what you're asking about are post-contract credit, so to speak. And we're not arguing that that should be credited at this point. We are arguing that the contract was complete and enforceable. There were no questions about the contract. And that's what we're stating now. So it's an enforceable contract, and the district court failed to enforce it.
Well, but you're saying that you accept it. I guess let's go to the premise that your client accepted under the terms. And the district court found that your client did not accept under the express terms. And it to put my cards on the table, I found the district court's conclusion on that point persuasive. So disabuse me.
Yeah. So the offer and acceptance was in 1982. Okay. So Evelyn offered to give Kevin an option to buy this farm at any time during his lifetime in 1982. So the offer and acceptance under contract law was completed in 1982.
Well, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about his exercise of his right. The letter that was written on his behalf that he supposedly had already made good on the contract, and at least of that date.
No, that letter was saying he's exercising his contract in July 23rd, 2000, or exercising his option to purchase in July 23rd, 2019. That's what that letter stated. And we didn't get a response from that letter. Okay. So we couldn't have a conversation about whether or not these credits should be applied, whether or not the $70,000, nothing. We did not get a response, but we clearly exercised our option at that time to buy. And
when you say clearly, I mean, that's a characterization the district court didn't accept. And unless you convince me otherwise, I don't see anything clear about it. The lawyer writing a letter making representations that she didn't necessarily adopt, but that are assertions in a lawyer's letter. I'm not persuaded that there was, in fact, an acceptance based upon this letter. And go ahead and explain why I'm wrong.
That was entered into evidence, the letter from myself to Evelyn Bruntlett, sent to her attorneys in fact. And the letter said, we are now exercising our option. Okay, so that's what's required under the option agreement that was done back in 1982. And they never responded to it. So I don't know what more we could have done at that point. They didn't respond. So, you know, they didn't accept Kevin's right to buy this. And that's where they breached the contract. But he did everything reasonable under the circumstances, indicating it's now time to exercise the option.
But counsel, didn't in that letter, by invoking this idea of contributions on the firm, didn't you propose different terms to the original contract?
No, we never proposed different terms to the original contract. We had proposed that some of these should be credited because of what Kevin and Evelyn had agreed upon.
But isn't that a different term? Because there's no talk about that in the original contract, that somehow there's going to be credit for work on the farm.
We had exercised the option to buy the farm for $200,000, as was their right. That's what the letter said. Okay, we're exercising the option, and then it becomes there was no response. I don't know what else we could have done here.
Well, if the letter itself seems to be, let me just be candid with you. If the letter itself seems to be a disingenuous attempt to acquire property on terms that are not in the original agreement, why would there need to be a response?
It was not disingenuous, Your Honor.
Let's assume it appears to be, by making claims to ownership, by saying that the property's already, we've already paid for it. Let's assume that one might reasonably construe that as disingenuous. If that's so, would there be a reason to respond to it?
Yes, there's a reason to respond to it. They had their obligation to do that. I mean, that's how a real estate sale is going to happen. You can't unilaterally complete a real estate sale and having no response. And you know, Heidi Brunlett testified at trial that she got the letter and just simply didn't respond.
The counsel, wait a minute, just I have to go back to this. It isn't so much a sale as it is demanding transfer of the property, saying it's paid for now due to all this credit for work on the farm. So it changes the terms in the sense that it's saying you aren't doing any more money.
I respectfully disagree with that. I don't know how else we could have completed this conversation.
Well, I'm not sure what you're disagreeing with. Your letter says, in summary, Kevin has already met his obligation to pay $200,000 for the remaining property. That was your representation in the letter. And if that's not, and it's based on terms that weren't in the original option, the idea that you're going to have this labor instead of cash transfer is nowhere in the original agreement. And so I'm hard pressed to see how this is anything other than a demand for conveyance of ownership as opposed to an offer. There's no offer to purchase here in the letter. Correct me if I'm wrong. Show me where in the letter there's an offer to purchase.
If I concede that point, I'd like to move on to latches. Okay, I don't concede that point, but I understand what you're saying. This was an invitation for a conversation, okay? And if it was a clear indication to exercise the option and then determine, you know, what's been paid, what hasn't been paid. But how does the judge then go on to permanently terminate this option with the argument of latches?
Well, you would agree. Well, the judge did two things. Retrospectively apply latches and prospectively apply latches. You would agree that if there was never a genuine exercise, if the district court is correct, there was never a genuine exercise of the option, that we don't have to get to the latches issue as to retrospective, and your argument really would go as to the prospective application of latches only.
So that I agree with that. I mean, so how do you terminate forever this option contract that, you know, by its terms, it gives Kevin a right to exercise it anytime during his lifetime? And that's where the latches argument fails. If you guys are correct and this wasn't a clear indication, which I don't agree with, of a right to, you know, his intent to exercise the option, how does the option go away forever when by its terms it gives Kevin a right during his lifetime to buy on this? So that is where the latches argument fails. And this option.
Your position is that Evelyn's change in circumstances, that the application of latches the other siblings can use the farmland to finance her continued care is not a reasonable exercise of the equitable doctrine?
No. The doctrine is, you know, of latches is sitting on a legal right, and his legal right to sue, you know, happened in July of 2019 when they didn't honor the option contract.
But it's not a question of the legal right to sue. It's a legal question is whether he was diligent in exercising his option. Pursuant to the actual terms of the option, the $25,000 down payment and then payments in successive years.
Okay, but you say that he didn't do that, but how does that terminate it forever? That's my point with the latches argument. I mean, the latches are, the option agreement is there for his life.
And are we looking at that issue about whether the district court properly applied latches for abuse of the district court's discretion?
I would argue that's a de novo. That's an application of law.
Even though it's an equitable doctrine?
Yes.
And there was a court trial?
Yes.
Give that proposition.
I'm sorry?
What's the authority for that proposition?
The standard, I think either way you look at it, whether it's a de novo review or an abuse of discretion, it was an incorrect decision by the judge. There's absolutely no precedent at law to apply latches in any other context than waiting to sue. There isn't. I mean, the respondent cited a case law from 1891 in Michigan. There's simply no law on that. So even if Kevin didn't properly exercise his option, the option still has to be there. And he has the right to go back and properly exercise the option if that's what the court requires.
Can I, when I look at pages 20 through 22 of the district court's order on latches, is there a particular finding that you're claiming is clearly erroneous, not supported by the record, or was an abuse of the district court's discretion, considering that the district court in this case was the fact finder? Which one of these paragraphs is the one that you're claiming is the error that triggers a reversal?
I don't have that in front of me. I can pull it up here. But again,
maybe you can address it on rebuttal, counsel.
Okay. There's simply no precedent of using latches to terminate this contract. It has to be restored. There's nothing in the contract that's clear. This should have been done at summary judgment. I don't understand why it wasn't done at summary judgment.
What should have been done at summary judgment?
The whole matter should have been resolved. I mean, the parole evidence shouldn't have been included. This was all in the terms of the contract. The 1982 option agreement had everything it needed to have. That's the contract that we're dealing with. And now they've terminated that, even though it gives him a right to exercise the option anytime during his lifetime. And he's still living. He's sitting right here. And then they go on to use the rule of perpetuities because she knew she wasn't on solid ground on that. And the rule of perpetuities doesn't apply because it does expire upon his life. So she knew she wasn't on solid ground on this thing. This thing should have been settled on contract principles. And there's nothing to invalidate the 1982 contract. It needs to be restored.
Thank you. Your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you'd like to use that time. Counsel for respondent.
Okay. May I proceed? I'm sorry.
Yes, the floor is yours.
Sorry. Thank you, Your Honors. Jonathan Bai here on behalf of the successors to the respondents, who are the siblings of the appellant. First, if I could just touch on a point, answer Judge Frisch's question on the standard of review on the latches issue. If you look at page 15 of appellant's brief, appellant says that the decision whether to apply latches lies within the district court's discretion and will be reversed only for an abuse of that discretion. So in their brief, appellant agrees it's an abuse of discretion standard.
Can I address the latches issue? I'll tell you, as with Mr. Johnson, I will with you, just put all my cards on the table. I have some trouble with the latches decision in this regard, and you can correct my impression, but assuming that the district court was correct in saying that there was no exercise of the option in the letter that Mr. Johnson sent in July, then the latches issue doesn't matter as to retrospective. We don't have to get to that question. And I'm wondering whether the question of latches going forward is ripe for the court as a matter of justiciability. If there hasn't been an attempt after the first attempt to exercise the option, why isn't the district court's latches decision merely advisory? Like, this is what we'd do in the future if it were raised, but there's no future claim yet made that there's been another attempt to exercise the option. So you see what my trouble is, and go ahead and move me to what you think is the right place if I'm wrong.
Sure. If not explicitly, implicitly, the parties were asking for a declaration of the continued enforceability of the option.
Well, and there's a big difference between an express claim for a declaratory judgment and the district court just going out and saying, we're done here. You can never raise another challenge, another contract challenge based upon your attempt to exercise your rights. It seems to me to be beyond the court's authority as a matter of justiciability, just giving an advisory opinion about what might happen in the future if a claim is brought. Again, I can be pushed off of this, but that's how I looked at this. I saw no one addressed it, but it's a matter of jurisdiction that we have to consider.
Well, I don't think the court didn't just come up with that, the trial court. I mean, the parties did ask for the application of latches going ahead. in the post-trial briefing. And I think that if you find that they asked for it, I mean, this would fall within the ability of the court. We have a contract and a dispute over that contract and a request for a declaration as to the meaning and enforceability of that contract. So I think there is.
But only after trial, before there was an opportunity to present any evidence, if there's any to present. You understand why I'd be a little, why there's at least a procedural concern that I have, whether I'm right or not. It's just my first impression. The parties didn't brief it, but it's certainly one of some concern.
I'll have to take a moment to see, to actually look at the pleadings to see if it was raised, but I think it was certainly raised. It was a tried issue that was tried.
I don't doubt that Latches was raised, but whether it was raised in a prospective sense is one that I'm just not certain about, and you can point me to someplace in the record if I'm wrong about that.
Well, if you look at the answer of the defendant in the wherefore clause, paragraph 4 was for a declaration that the option is not a valid and enforceable contract. And one of the affirmative defenses that was asserted was Latches. So I think it was raised and a litigated issue.
All right.
And just to tie that off, Mr. Bai, when this issue was presented in post-trial motions, was there an objection that the consideration of the prospective application of Latches by the district court was erroneous or an abuse of its discretion?
No, I don't believe so, no.
All right, thank you.
Well, can you go to the merits of that issue? I know there's other issues you'd like to talk about, but let's assume it's in play and address the merit of a contract that is purported on its face to exist for the life of one of the parties. The party is still alive. On what ground would, I'm trying to have a sense of Latches applying. I understand the district court's concern about Kevin sort of hiding the ball, not telling his siblings about this supposed acceptance in 2019, but that I don't know how that bears upon the Latches question prospectively. So if you could, I have some concerns about the substance then, if we're not procedurally barred.
Mr. Bai, as you respond to Judge Ross, would you also respond to the issue of raised in the judge's findings that part of the problem is that the appellant failed to exercise the rights in the contract and became a burden on the mother's financial well-being? She passed away 9 months ago, so that's no longer an issue. How does that impact matters?
Sure. I will touch on that as well, Your Honor. First of all, just in we have to remember that the doctrine of Latches only comes up where there's an issue where the contract is otherwise enforceable. So the fact that the contract on its face was enforceable for the lifetime of Kevin, that is why we're talking about Latches. So it only comes up when it bars a right which one otherwise has. So the mere fact that we're seeking and the trial court barred a right that the contract allows, that's the nature of the doctrine. And as to why the court felt that it should apply here, I mean, we do have a 37-year delay. That's certainly a long period of time. There is no evidence in the record that from the date of the execution of the option that it was ever discussed by the parties again in the 37 years that transpired. The trial court found, based on the evidence, that either Evelyn forgot about it or believed that Kevin was not going to enforce it based on the conduct. And part of that conduct was the fact that on almost a dozen occasions, the terms of the option were ignored or breached in terms of that there were a number of different conveyances of the property. There were 3-year leases entered into. There was the devotion of the land to CRP, which would have been a violation of the option. So almost from the get-go, there were violations of the terms of the option to the point where we sit today. I don't know how you could possibly enforce it. I mean, we don't. The acreage is 2/3 of what it was, and who knows what price you would impose. This was not acreage which was equally valued. There were buildings on part of it. Part of it was tillable. Part of it was not. You can't just apportion it and say, oh, well, he's entitled to exercise an option for 2/3 of it at 2/3 of the price. So the fact that it was that it was violated and ignored, that there the trial court found, and it has not been challenged, that there was no modification of the option agreement, means that to try to enforce it 37 years later, after one of the participants is essentially unable to speak because of her dementia. And the trial court found that he felt that Kevin had intentionally hid this from his siblings and from had not re-raised it with his mother. The other factor that comes in here is that there are questionable circumstances with respect to the execution of the document. And we can no longer inquire about those because of the wait of 37 years until Evelyn was suffering from dementia. That's another reason that the delay is unreasonable. And finally, the fact that she made decisions about her care and how what she would do in selling the portion of the property that were clearly based on the fact that she believed that it was her property and that when she died, it would go, whatever was left would go equally to the four children. Now, turning to Judge Cleary's question, I don't think something can be barred by latches and then become unbarred because of a change in circumstances after the fact. Otherwise, there'd be no finality. So if this court were to have agreed immediately after the trial that the judge acted correctly, that enforcement of the contract was barred by latches, to then allow relitigation after the fact because of some subsequent change in circumstances, I'm just not aware of any jurisprudence which would allow undoing a determination that latches barred the enforcement.
Are you aware of any authority where latches is applied to cure a delay, a long delay, in the exercise of a contractual right when the contract itself repeatedly refers to the rights being perpetual and enforceable at any time?
Well, whether they refer to it as perpetual or not, I mean, when latches is applied, it is applied to a contract that is enforceable. Or again,
I understand that. And I think what happens in latches is the court is overlaying a reasonable time period as a term of the contract, essentially, when the parties haven't addressed it. But when the parties have expressly addressed it, that's what I'm asking you, whether you found any authority to support the idea that a time-based application of latches has existed in to avoid a contract where the contract itself expresses a perpetual nature of the rights of the parties.
Well, I guess in part I would I don't have any authority to directly answer your question right off the top of my head. But the doctrine of that a contract which is of indefinite length is terminable at will, you know, that's a separate and distinct argument. And the trial court also adopted that in connection with the post-trial motions. But I mean, the doctrine of latches assumes that the contract is enforceable. It is not a determination. It is not a determination that by virtue of the length that we're talking about, that the contract is unenforceable. It's a separate doctrine. And so the fact that this contract If it said 50 years, 60 years, perpetual, that doesn't prevent the application of the doctrine under the appropriate equitable circumstances, which again, it's up to the finder of fact to make those equitable determinations, which is what this trial court did, finding, among other things, that that Kevin actively hid the existence of this agreement, and that he his testimony was not credible on a number of fronts, and under the circumstances where Evelyn needed to be planning and was planning for her care, based on her finding that the Evelyn understood that either she had forgotten about it because he had sat on his rights, or that she understood he was not going to enforce his rights, as evidenced by the fact that they had breached it on a number of occasions in the preceding.
Speak to the revocability. Assume that Evelyn was in her right mind and could have. Your position is that she had the authority, that she wasn't bound by the agreement, that she could revoke it.
Yes, that's under the court's alternative holding, that it was essentially a contract in perpetuity, and that one has unless a contract is specific in that regard, that one has the right to terminate it at will, and that she, in essence, it was terminated at will by her deed transmitting the property upon her death, on the letter that she sent to all of the children, telling them that the property was in all of their names, and also obviously by the refusal when the option was supposedly exercised to honor that. All of those are indications that it was terminated, and there is no on the portion of the agreement which opposing counsel ignores is the portions which forbid the either the leasing of the property or mortgaging of the property, in which there is no termination date stated with those. And I see I've used my time, so thank you.
Thank you. It doesn't appear as if either of my colleagues have any further questions for you. All right. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you'd like to use it.
Yes, thank you. I would. First, I'm going to address Judge Frisch earlier question.
Just a reminder to go ahead and state your name for this leg of your argument.
Sorry. David Johnson again on behalf of appellant Kevin Bruntlett.
Thank you.
Yes. So to address the earlier question about whether the court had incorrect findings on the doctrine of latches, they did. I mean, even if latches does apply somehow prospectively, which it doesn't, the application of the doctrine is that you need to show that it prejudiced Evelyn here. And that's completely contrary to what actually happened. Kevin could have bought this at any time for $200,000, but he knew that she was living off of this property. The income from the rental, CRP payments, all the income off of that from 1982 until 2018 went to Evelyn when it could have been his. Okay, so he was being a good guy. He didn't exercise it because he wanted his mother to have a decent standard of living, and she did have a decent standard of living.
So you're saying then, just so we're clear, it was somehow impossible for him to exercise his right of ownership and still allow her to have the rent proceeds. If that's your argument, explain the legal basis why that would possibly be so.
I don't think that's, I mean, they could by contract do that, for sure they could, but he didn't, because he was thinking that, and he testified to this at trial, that, you know, as long as she owns it, she's going to be entitled to the income, and there was no reason to transfer it at that time because he was looking out for her.
But if he's looking out for her, I'm just trying to understand why. I mean, there's two alternative universes here. Either he's just being kind of slippery and cunning, as the district court seemed to believe, or he was being benevolent. And if he wanted to be benevolent, what would prevent him from saying openly to all of his siblings and to his mom when she's in her right state of mind, I'm going to exercise my right to own the property, but I'm going to make sure that you get to continue to receive income, that you'll be taken care of. I'm not taking any money from the rent. Nothing prohibits him from doing that, correct? If that's what, if benevolence was really what was motivating him?
Well, it was. And I don't know, you know, the dynamics of the family and the conversations about this, but, it, you know, in my mind, it's not really relevant. You know,
counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. I know we only have a few minutes here, but if that's the case, why not exercise the option at any point and retain a life estate for her, and she would retain the farm income, and he would get the property upon her demise?
Believe me, looking back at this, I wish that would have happened, but it didn't, because it just didn't happen. He wasn't represented by counsel. He didn't know. I mean, he didn't know he was going to have this kind of problem coming forward. But again, the analysis that she needs to be prejudiced by this, and the judge said she would be prejudiced by it because she has to pay for nursing care going forward, that makes no sense. It didn't make any sense at all. She was benefited by this thing, clearly. And Judge Frisch had asked about, you know, that those issues and those findings, and they're incorrect. I mean, she got so much more money off of this by him not exercising the option. And then she uses that to turn it against him and take the option away. So the latches, you know, it doesn't apply. But if it did apply, she misapplied the elements of the latches. It's got to be an unreasonable delay, which it can't be because he had a whole lifetime to do it. And it's got to prejudice her, which it clearly did not. It benefited her. Opposing counsel had indicated that latches was not addressed in the post-trial motions. It was
it benefited her unless her intent was not to convey the property to Kevin. It would certainly prejudice her if her intent was to make sure all of her children had an equal share in the property. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, but I that goes back to that. Can she unilaterally revoke this thing? And she can't. It's a contract. I mean, she can't just say, you know, I don't want it to happen anymore. The contract was valid. And the judge, you know, made clear that, or made it in her findings that she knew it was valid. So she can't unilaterally, you know, just revoke that. And the transfer and death deed in these later letters do nothing to revoke the contract. You can't do that. That's not contract law. So. And then going back to latches was strenuously argued at the post-trial motions. And that's when she came up with her rule against perpetuities reasoning, which also didn't make any sense because she wasn't comfortable with her latches reasoning. I'm out of time. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. The matter is.